You're tuned to Perspectives, a weekly public affairs show which airs every Saturday right here on KTEP. And joining us today is Ben Bradley Jr. Ben is the author of the recent book, The Kid, The Immortal Life of Ted Williams. Ben, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks a lot. Glad to be here.
First of all, The Kid, you mentioned in your introduction that you were always a big fan of Ted Williams and the Boston Red Sox.
Right.
And you start off with that to kind of give the reader, I guess, and the listener about a little bit about yourself and you got interested in Ted Williams.
Right. Well, I grew up in Boston, outside Boston, in Cambridge, Mass. And I'm old enough that I saw Williams play in the last part of his career in the late 50s. And my bedroom, you know, was plastered with pictures of Ted Williams, clipped from Sport Magazine and Sports Illustrated. And, you know, I, like many of kids in the Boston area, was quite smitten by him. He was the hero of the day and I think the greatest hitter who ever lived. And I would go to the park, Fenway Park, any chance that I could. I got his autograph as a kid once, hanging out in the players' parking lot where they would come and collect their cars after the games. And he signed the ball for me on the sweet spot. And I still have that ball, the ink fading badly with the passage of more than 50 years. And he was kind of a spellbinder, Williams. You know, he electrified the crowd. When he came to bat, you didn't think of leaving your seat to go get a hot dog. There was electricity in the air.
Now, did you ever imagine that you were going to end up writing a story about Ted Williams?
Oh, certainly not. You know, as a kid, how can you – you don't even know what you're going to do in life. But when I was 25 years at the Boston Globe as a reporter and editor, and, you know, I followed Ted in his retirement. And when he died in 2002, I was struck by how much interest there still was in his life and how many lives he had touched. And I remember the Boston Globe ran a page of letters to the editor, and they were from grandfathers talking about how much Williams had meant to their sons, that who they had taken to Fenway Park, and those sons in turn would write about how important he was to their sons. So he was sort of a glue in the social fabric. And I took a look at the early books that had been done on Williams, and they'd been mostly by sports writers who concentrated on his exploits on the field. But I was not a sports writer. My background is in the news side of the business. And I was interested, I decided not to skimp on the baseball part of his life, but I was more interested in the unchronicled personal parts of his life, like his growing up in Depression-era San Diego with a very hard family background. Like the fact that he was Mexican-American, which hardly anyone knew.
That was one of the things that I was going to bring up, the fact that you start your book by saying that Ted was very ashamed of his background and upbringing.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't just the being Mexican-American that he was ashamed of. It was his mother who was Mexican, and she was born in
Chihuahua, I believe, right?
Yes, I believe Chihuahua. I can't remember right off the top of my head. But she and her parents and grandparents and ancestors went back as far back as I could trace in Mexico. And yet Williams decided to conceal this fact about himself. He was worried that the prejudice of the day could hurt his baseball career. And one of the first things I did in going out to start my research in this book started in San Diego, where he grew up, but learned that most of his relatives on the Mexican side of the family had settled in Santa Barbara, north of Los Angeles. And so I went there and found a friendly cousin who agreed to put together a meeting for me with the extended Mexican side of the family. And that was really interesting. And the first thing you noted was how much darker they are than Ted, who was quite white. And he obviously got his father's Anglo looks, and he carried the name Williams. So no one suspected that he was Mexican-American. And these cousins told me a fascinating story about what happened in 1939 at the end of his rookie season with the Red Sox, where he had set the American League on fire. And he returned to San Diego, the conquering hero, and about 100 of the Mexican relatives gathered at the train station to greet him in triumph. And Ted got off the train and took one look at the Mexican relatives and hightailed it in the other direction. He didn't want to be seen with them, and that still sticks in the craw of some of these folks and their descendants today.
His mother's maiden name was Venzer, if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that he seems was ashamed of, the fact that his mother was very involved with the Salvation Army?
Right. She was a very well-known figure on the streets of San Diego, and she was a soldier in the Salvation Army, and that's was the most important thing in her life. And her mission stretched from the Mexican border in Tijuana all the way to Los Angeles, but she concentrated in San Diego, where she was well-known, well-respected by the mayor and other political figures. And she thought that the most important thing in life was to walk the streets of San Diego and save as many souls as she could. And she would be out until late at night doing just that and not home for her children, Ted and his younger brother, Danny. So they grew up, some of the first latchkey kids, if you will, sitting home on the porch late at night waiting for their mother to come home. The father was an alcoholic and largely absent and not a factor, really, in Ted's life. So he grew up with this resentment, I think, of his mother for not being home for him, and was embarrassed at his family's poor circumstances.
There was a big difference, as you mentioned, his brother Danny, between Ted and Danny.
Danny was sort of a hellion, and he was turned to petty crime very early in life. Was always one step ahead of the sheriff, getting in trouble. A well-known figure to San Diego police, and was always ending up on the police blotter for one thing or another. And he was quite jealous of Ted, and they didn't get along much or have much of a relationship.
One of the things that you mentioned in your book as well, you mentioned the train station incident, but at one point I believe the family went to see him play, and he pretty much did the same thing. He kind of ignored him.
Yes, right. They were, waving their arms at him in the stands. I think this was at a exhibition game in Los Angeles. And he made a motion to them like he would see them after the game, but he never did. And so that was another incident. You're right.
Interestingly enough, people who are listening to this might think, well, he was a racist or he just disowned his family. But you have to understand the times that he grew up in, and he was definitely, as you mentioned, afraid that this could hurt his career. And he became a big advocate for people like Jackie Robinson and other great athletes.
Yes, and so there's a certain irony in that. He had grown up playing ball against the black athletes. His high school in San Diego was not integrated, but in playing high school ball and later in the minor leagues, he'd played against the black players, including Jackie Robinson, who grew up in Pasadena outside Los Angeles. And when Robinson became the first black player in the major leagues to integrate baseball in 1947, Ted sent him a letter of congratulations. And when Larry Doby became the first black player in the American League with the Cleveland Indians, Williams would go out of his way to befriend him and make him feel welcome. The Red Sox, under Tom Yawkey, embarrassingly, were the last major league team to integrate, and that was not until 1959 when Williams was still playing, and the player was Pumpsy Green, and he would go out of his way to befriend Green and warm up with him in front of the dugout before games. But where he really earned his stripes, Williams, in combating racism, was in 1966 when he was elected to the Hall of Fame. And during his speech at Cooperstown, he called on the directors of the Hall of Fame to admit the old Negro League players, Satchel Paige, Josh Gibson, et al., who had been excluded under the rules of the Hall of Fame. And Bowie Kuhn, then the commissioner of baseball, who respected Williams greatly, took this under advisement and got it done. So Williams was a great hero to the black players, and we can only speculate, but I think that his own background as a Mexican-American who must have been aware of prejudice, at least, might have had something to do with that.
Ben, as you know, baseball is, they call it America's pastime, but it's favored in a lot of countries, and particularly Latin America, Mexico.
Right.
And now we have a lot of Latin American players in the league.
Sure.
Did Ted get to play with some of those, or was that after his retirement?
Well, it was mostly after his retirement. Major League Baseball is really becoming a Latin game. I think at least a third, if not 40% of all Major League Baseball players now are Hispanic. But there weren't anywhere near those numbers in Williams's day.
The Kid, as he was affectionately known, was very well known too. As Kurt Gowdy mentioned, that if you were walking down the street and you told him, there's one of the best carpenters I've known, that he would go up to the man and shake his hand because he wanted to identify with the common man. He didn't want to go to these high society parties and all that stuff. He would make friends with the chauffeur, the doorman, the policeman.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was that, but he also was curious about what other people did. He was bright, Williams. He didn't have a formal education beyond high school, and he was always very sensitive about that. But he was curious about how, if somebody did something well, he was curious about how they got to do it so well. So if he encountered a carpenter, he would want to know exactly how you did something. And he strove for excellence, Ted Williams did, in anything that he undertook. He was an elite Marine Corps fighter pilot in both World War II and Korea. And he was a world-class fisherman and was inducted into two different fishing halls of fame. So he was really accomplished in a variety of fields and didn't have much patience for those who did things in what he felt were a shoddy manner.
And a lot of people who aren't baseball fans remember Ted Williams as an outdoorsman. And the fact that, as you mentioned, he wanted to do his best at everything he did, a lot of people don't know that besides being an excellent fisherman, an excellent hunter, he was also very well known for tying his own fishing flies.
Flies, yeah, yeah. Oh, he had a workshop. He spent many of his adult years living in the Florida Keys, an island called Isla Morada, and up in New Brunswick, Canada, where he kept a cabin in the summertime where he would go fishing for Atlantic salmon. In both of those places, he had these little tool shops, work sheds, where he would spend hours and hours and hours tying these very intricate flies. And that was one of his favorite hobbies, and he did it, you know, meticulously.
As you mentioned, integration, even back then, journalism was pretty much a man's job. Mm-hmm. And they referred to the newspaper guys as boys, okay, the newsboys. So Ted did not have particularly fondness for these newsboys.
Yeah, well, sports they really called it was all newspapers back then.
Yes.
And they were called the baseball writers and known in the trade as the writers, really. There was no television yet. And some radio, but it was newspaper writers who set the agenda. And Williams always used them as his whipping boy, and he struggled with anger in his life. Maybe we'll talk a little bit more about that later, and that was kind of rooted, as we discussed, in resentment of his mother. But he would try to use this anger constructively on the baseball field, because he said that he always hit better mad, or he nurtured his rage, as one of the writers of the day put it. And he would use the writers as his foil. You know, he would claim that they were unfair to him, even though he generally got a good press. If he took a bad column by a columnist and there were some who didn't like him, he would try to tar all the press with the broad brush and say, "You're all lousy, you're all out to get to me." He was naive, Williams, about the role of the press. He wanted fame, but not the inconvenience of celebrity. And he resented it if the writers would pry into his family life, he felt, unnecessarily. Even if a reporter would call his mother to do a favorable feature story about Ted, he thought that that was an invasion of his privacy. And he would call the writer out on it and say, "Look, you can only write about what's happening on the baseball field. I don't want you to write about my private life." So that was very naive of him. He just didn't understand the way the press worked. And he would give them, he would always be on them. And some of his teammates were amused by this because they never would dare treat the writers the way Ted did. And one of his teammates in the 50s, Don Budden, told me a story. He was a shortstop for the Red Sox in the 50s, and he remembered saying to Ted one day, "Ted, how can you treat the writers this way? It's really incredible the way you treat them." And Ted said, "Son, if you hit 350, you can do a lot of things."
Tell us about, there are a lot of athletes that people look at and say, these guys are just prima donnas. Mm-hmm. And they use their anger or they use whatever to kind of manipulate people. How would you compare Ted Williams to the athletes of today?
So that's an interesting question. You would have to call Williams a prima donna, I suppose, in the way he chose to relate to the press. As I said, he always thought they were prying. But he related very differently also. I mean, today, he was so colorful, Williams. He was such good cop. And today's athlete, I suppose you can say, with the most recently, with the notable exception of Richard Sherman, the Seattle Seahawks cornerback who popped off on national television. But that's a rarity. Most interviews with superstar athletes today are incredibly boring because they speak in cliches. They don't want to get in trouble. Williams was brutally honest. He was unvarnished, spoke with candor. And he would say, "Ted, what kind of year are you going to have this upcoming season?" And he'd say, "Who's going to stop me?" That kind of thing, you know? I mean, no one would talk like that today. And he was, I suppose you could call it braggadocio, but he would back it up.
But there was another side to Ted Williams that a lot of people didn't know about. And there's a part in your book where you talk about this father who is walking down the street. His son had been looking forward to watching the Red Sox play, but he got sick. He had the flu. So his father flags Ted Williams down on the street and says, "Hey, come on over to my house and meet my son." And Ted got in the car.
Yeah. Well, he had, I think this was one of his great redeeming traits, because while he did struggle with anger, he had a fundamental kindness and decency about him as well. He had a good heart. And this was evidenced chiefly by the work that he did for a charity in Boston called the Jimmy Fund, which was devoted to helping kids who had cancer. And back then, the cancer was almost always fatal. And Williams would gravitate towards these kids and tell the doctors and nurses in the hospital, give them his phone number and say, "Call me any hour of the day or night if you feel I can be useful and cheer up some of these kids." So he would go there by the hour and get down on the floor at their level and sometimes even stay overnight. And he always insisted that there be no press to cover of this, because he was worried that if it appeared in the papers, it would look self-serving. And it wasn't. It was genuine. He really cared about this. And not just helping sick kids, but as you mentioned, if there were somebody in a strange city and who wanted to meet him, he would try and make that happen.
I mean, this is going beyond the call of duty. The time where you write about the fact that a doctor, an oncologist, had called him about this child who might not make it through the night. Could he send him a baseball? And he said, sure, I can. And he, even though he was playing that evening, he flew down to, I think it was one of the Carolinas.
Yeah, and, right.
And gave the kid a ball?
Yeah. He was in Washington at the time and chartered a plane and flew down to North Carolina, delivered a signed ball in person to the kid, and then flew back in time for the game. So, yeah, he would go above and beyond. And later in retirement, you know, he stayed with it. He had a lifelong relationship with that charity and the Jimmy Fund. And he would call up some of his friends, like some of the old-time baseball players, a lot of whom were financially struggling. He'd call up an old teammate and he'd say, I'm trying to raise money for the Jimmy Fund. And the guy would hem and haw and say, geez, Ted, you know, I'm kind of hurting. And he'd say, damn it, this is Ted Williams. Send me a check for $10. So the guy would send a check for $10, and he would take down the number of the account on the check and wire the guy $1,000 anonymously. So he would do that kind of thing. He had a kindness about him as well as a harshness.
Let's talk a little bit about his kids, in particular John Henry. Mm-hmm. John Henry, it seems like he was kind of using his father, I guess, as a stepping stone and also as a key to open doors.
Mm-hmm.
And some people call them lazy. Tell us a little bit about John Henry, because you are the son of a famous person as well.
Well, yeah, my father was editor of the Washington Post. He's 92 now and doing pretty well for 92.
Congratulations.
But John Henry was a 21-year-old kid just out of college. Williams, just to set a little more background, he had three marriages and three children. An older daughter, Bobby Joe, from the first marriage, and two children, a son, John Henry, and a daughter, Claudia, by the third marriage. So John Henry comes along, and Ted, he didn't have much of a relationship with his children at all growing up. He was distant. He was self-absorbed. He was involved in his career. And, you know, late in life, he would reflect on his record as a husband and a father, and he would say, in those areas, I struck out. Those were his very words. But he did try. The last part of the book is really about the story of a father and a son trying to reconnect for the first time. And that started to happen in 1991 when John Henry just graduated from college and was looking around for something to do. And that happened to be the 50th anniversary of Williams's hitting 406. He's the last major league player to hit 400. And John Henry thought it would be a nice thing to do to somehow recognize that 50th anniversary. So he proposed just like a modest T-shirt venture to his father. And his father was just coming off an episode where he had been swindled in the memorabilia market to the tune of about $1 million by a dishonest broker. And John Henry said, well, Dad, you can trust me because I'm your son. And so he filled the void, and Ted was receptive to that argument. And, I think he so was feeling guilty about not being there for the son. So he wanted to up until that time. And so he decided to reward him and trust him and let him gradually take over his memorabilia business. And the kid went through millions of dollars and certainly exploited his father's fame. But I also concluded in the book that he loved his father because he was there at the end doing the hard, nitty-gritty work that the kids do when their parents get old and frail. So I have to give him that as well.
The big question, I guess you mentioned this at the beginning of the book, and a lot of people remember this, and that's the cryonics.
Right.
He had mentioned in his will that he wanted to be cremated, and his sister, of course, fought this, but John Henry had already faxed the papers and everything else, and that's what happened.
Right. Well, cryonics, for those of your listeners who don't know what it is, and that's all, there's a lot of people who don't, it's not a science really, but it's a belief that medical science will one day advance to the point where it will be possible to cure you of whatever it is you died from, and that you'll somehow be brought back to life. So they freeze the body after you die and preserve it. And a lot of holes in the theory, a lot of things they haven't worked out, like if Ted came back, would he come back as an 83-year-old man or a young stud who could hit 400 again? But John Henry got involved in this in 1997 and became a believer. And he himself died suddenly in 2004, about 18 months after Ted did, and to his credit, went through with cryonics himself, because if he hadn't, you know, he would have looked like a hypocrite after really pressing Ted to do this. So his remains are frozen with Ted's out in this facility in Scottsdale, Arizona, called Alcor.
Well, Ben, we want to thank you very much for taking the time with us. We've been visiting with Ben Bradley, Jr. He is the author of the book, The Kid, The Immortal Life of Ted Williams, and it's available, as we mentioned, at various bookstores, Amazon, and it's available also as a Kindle or ebook. Ben, thank you very much for taking the time to be with us here today.
Thanks very much. I enjoyed it.
Katie Casey was baseball mad. She had the fever and she had it bad. Just to root for the hometown crew, every cent that Katie spent. On one Saturday, her young beau called to see if she'd like to go to see a show, but Miss Kate said no. I'll tell you what you can do. Take me out to the ball game. Take me out with the crowd. Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jacks. I don't care if I ever get back, 'cause it's root, root, root for the home team. If they don't win, it's a shame, 'cause it's one, two, three strikes, you're out at the old ball game. Katie Casey saw all the games, knew all the players by their first names, told the umpire he was wrong all along, and she was strong. When the score was 2-2, Katie Casey, she had the clue to cheer on the boy. She knew just what to do. She made everyone sing the song. Take me out to the ball game. Take me out with the crowd. Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jacks. I do not care if I ever get back, 'cause it's root, root, root for the home team. If they don't win, it's a shame, 'cause it's one, two, three strikes, you're out at the old ball game. Take me out to the ball game. Take me out with the crowd. Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jacks. I don't care if I ever get back, 'cause it's root, root, root for the home team. If they don't win, it's a shame.
Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Luis Sainz.